Welcome to Scientifica, the premier podcast where the latest scientific discoveries are discussed in the context of their apologetic significance to the Christian faith.
This is Average Joe Aguirre, joined today by members of our scholar team, astronomer Hugh Ross, biochemist Fuzz Rana, astrophysicist Jeff Zwerink, and molecular biologist A.J. Roberts. They will be sharing exciting research from the front lines of the scientific journals and discussing the apologetic implications. You will hear from each in round table fashion today. We have done the customary tossing of the dice, and the order, as it turns out, is Jeff will go first, AJ, Fuzz, and then Hugh. You guys have exciting reports from the journals, and we're going to hear the apologetic implications in just a moment. Jeff, you will go first, and you have a couple of papers to talk about today, both from Science Daily. The summary here, as you have given it to me on the first one, talks about research uncovering a direct link between changes in the Earth's crust 3 billion years ago and the introduction of free oxygen to the atmosphere. All right, this one sounds like another one of those circumstances where Earth had to have a lot of things going right for it at the outset.
Right. Well, I guess to kind of set the stage for this is that there seems to be kind of this idea that, you know, you make a planet, you wind it up, and if it's in the right place, you know, where it's the right distance from the star, it just kind of naturally unfolds and you end up with a place where life is flourishing. I mean, that idea is fairly popular out there. And what I find interesting is, you know, especially in the context of finding all of these extrasolar planets, where we're finding more and more what all went on the Earth and how dramatic the changes are. You know, and we have 20% oxygen in our atmosphere. And I always remember, yeah, just as a little side story, I remember thinking it was probably back about somewhere between fourth or sixth grade when I found out that we had 20% oxygen in the atmosphere. I'm thinking, you know, if oxygen is so great, why didn't God make the whole atmosphere oxygen? And recognized later that oxygen kind of causes problems if you have too much, especially because once you get a fire started, it's almost impossible to put out. But, you know, but we end up with this place where you got 20% oxygen, which, you know, if you're going to have large bodied organisms like humans and other things, you got to have. But when you look back very early in the Earth's history, there was virtually no free oxygen out in the atmosphere or in the oceans. And something happened between 4.5 billion years ago when the Earth formed and today, so that now there's abundant oxygen in the atmosphere. And both of these discoveries kind of relate to that process, because what we know is, as we look back through the scientific record, through the geologic record, is that somewhere around 2.5, 2.4, 2.7 billion years ago, Earth's atmosphere had an abundance of oxygen in it. Now, abundance is, you know, if it's 20% today, it's kind of on the order of 1 or 2%. It was just a fraction of what it is of today's level. But nonetheless, it had a permanent component in there. And what both of these two discoveries show is that the process bringing that about required more than just a few things happening. And particularly what you have to have one of the things you have to have for there to be oxygen is you got to have organisms that produce oxygen. And so photosynthetic organisms, as they interact with the environment, they consume materials and they give off oxygen. And so that will naturally lead to oxygen in the atmosphere, except that many things are very reactive and will react with the oxygen and convert it into other forms. So, you know, if you've got methane in the atmosphere, or methane in your environment, you've got hydrogen, those sorts of things, that will react very readily with the oxygen and deplete it. And so what they found is that by studying the early continents, they found two things that are very interesting. One is that there was a composition change in the continents about 3 billion years ago, right in this time where, you know, that kind of led to the oxygenation of the oceans and then ultimately the atmosphere. And particularly what happened is there was one element, olivine, that was present in the continents, or what would have been the landmass before that it dropped off dramatically afterwards. And so what that does, olivine is one of those things that in the presence of oxygen, it'll react and it'll consume all the oxygen. And so even if you have abundant microbes that are consuming elements in there and producing oxygen, the oxygen is going to react with the olivine and it's not going to accumulate in the oceans and in the atmosphere. And so something happened that triggered this change from a very olivine-rich continental crust to an olivine-poor continental crust and removed the thing that was consuming all the oxygen, and that's part of what allows the oxygen to increase in the atmosphere. Corresponding with that is another paper where they're looking at how plate tectonics happens. And what they find is that, you know, plate tectonics is this idea that Earth's surface is covered by these large plates that are largely rigid. They'll move and scrape around and subduct and move over one another, but they kind of float around on top of the mantle underneath. And that explains, you know, you can use that to explain why we have the mid-ocean ridges and why there are mountains and why things erode. And that sort of tectonic activity is adequate to explain the record back to about a little bit over 3 billion years ago. But just there was a study of the isotopes of in the landmass before and after that, and showed that the plate tectonic activity actually changed dramatically there as well. And you can tell that by the composition. You see this marked composition change. Now, they, in fairness, they don't know what exactly it looked like before that. But the picture you have is that, you know, early Earth had no oxygen in the atmosphere. Something other than normal plate tectonics was in operation up until about 3 billion years ago. There was abundant olivine in the continents that were formed prior to that. But around 3 billion years ago, whatever that plate tectonic regime happened shifted to what now happens, or what's more common today. That also changed the composition of the continents, which ultimately allows the organisms to put oxygen up in the atmosphere. And so what you have, or what I find interesting or intriguing about that, is that we readily acknowledge that advanced life requires oxygen. And so you got to have some mechanism for producing oxygen, excuse me, both in the oceans and in the atmosphere. But when we look at what happened to facilitate that on Earth, there seems to be a lot of these kind of coincidental things that all happen right around the same time that allow this oxygenation to happen. You know, and so we see it, you know, 3 billion to about 2.5 billion years ago, the change in the tectonics, the way tectonics happen, the change in the continental composition, and the bacterial influx of oxygen now allows a permanent oxygen component in Earth's atmosphere. And then we see something similar 500-700 million years ago, where the oxygen seemed to increase up to more current levels. And so to me, that just strikes, rather than you kind of start a planet and it all plays out and you end up with oxygen in the atmosphere, because we look at Mars, we look at Venus, very similar planets in a lot of ways. We would characterize them as habitable if they were around other stars. And they show no evidence of this process that led to oxygen being in the atmosphere, partially because they don't have any life. You know, so all of this is all predicated on there being life very early on the history of very early in Earth's history as well. And so, whereas this common picture is you kind of get a planet started and it all just plays out and you end up with life on it, it really more looks to me like you start with this planet that's uninhabitable, and then there's all of these vents that need to be orchestrated and put together in a right way so that we get a place that looks like Earth does today. And to me, you know, where you see that orchestration, that sign of divine activity, or that to me is a pointer to God had a purpose for what's going on here, not just kind of wound it up and let it play out. And so I think that's just kind of an interesting two discoveries here that are kind of related but independent, that all point show this kind of orchestration happening early in Earth's history to prepare a very very crucial component for human life here on Earth today.
What was the oxygen level prior to, say, advanced life?
As a good rule of thumb, I mean, and there are these numbers are not real tight, but if you go back before about 2.7, 2.8 billion years ago, there's essentially no oxygen in the atmosphere. If you go 2.7 to about 700 million years ago, it's on the order of 1% of the atmosphere. And then from 500 million to today, it's on the order of 20%. And there are fluctuations around all those numbers, but that's kind of a good baseline rule of thumb of what it looked like.
So that's what we need, is that percentage then.
Well, if you're going to have advanced organisms, what allows those advanced organisms to extract the energy they need is you need something like oxygen that allows the energy to be extracted from the elements or from the nutrients that are around. So
if we were to go find a planet, and you mentioned Venus or Mars, and we were to start, let's say someone said, hey, they've got plate tectonics and there's somewhat of an atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And they found oxygen at a percentage level, let's say it was 4%. Would they need to start looking for other components like an oxygen event similar to what we find
here? Well, I think
here?
If you found that one, if you found 4% oxygen, that'd be a pretty strong indicator that there's life on the planet, because there are very few abiotic processes that generate that quantity of oxygen. Now, there are some. I mean, there are some that generates oxygen. So finding oxygen in an atmosphere isn't a telltale signature, but it's a very strong indicator. But if you were to find it at the 4, 5, 6% level, that would be a pretty strong sign that there's life on the planet. And then you have to figure out, how does that oxygen get there? Mainly because oxygen is just so incredibly reactive, is that if it's around much, it's consumed by a lot of different materials. And so finding free oxygen, we kind of take it for granted because it's such a large component of our atmosphere, but it's chemically, that's not a very stable place to be unless you've got something that continually produces.
Well, how
it.
Would we do if we were in that kind of environment?
3, 4, or 5% oxygen instead of 20.
We'd be dead.
That's lower than what's on top of Mount Everest. I mean,
okay. All right. Well, there you go.
So that, it's pretty. You know, you get up above about, I think it's about 26,000 feet, and it's called the death zone. I mean, even though you can live up there, or you can not die immediately, you're in the process of dying because there's not enough oxygen.
Okay, so we need these events to be orchestrated.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Sounds good. And any other questions?
Well, when you look at the history of the Earth, what you see is this incredibly fine-tuned synergy between the geophysics and the life, so that you can sustain the plate tectonics throughout the whole history of life on Earth, but also build up the oxygen to where advanced life is possible. So you have to fine-tune both the history of life, and you also have to fine-tune all the geophysics. So yeah, this is a great confirmation of that model.
Sounds good. Thank you for that, Jeff. Okay, well, let's go over to AJ now. AJ, I found this one interesting because I was able to print out the Nature article. That's always a good thing when I'm able to print out the article and find a nice picture of a mouse there, mouse mother and offspring, particularly when it concerns the ability to cross over into human beings and the potential to help out our species. And I think that's one of the bottom line applications you want to get at here, especially when I find the word autism in there. So tell us about the potential here when it comes to neurodevelopmental disorders. I don't want to get ahead of the game there, but it looks like a potential exciting application.
I think there. So, yeah. So it's okay to offer that teaser up front, Joe. I like that. So one of the things that we do in science, obviously, is that we make inferences, and we use, especially in human disease studies, we use animal models as often as we can to sort of pick apart what might be going on in humans. But two articles in Nature caught my eye this past week, and they have to deal with building a model for autistic spectrum disorder and other neurological and psychological disorders using a mouse model, but with some observed correlates in humans that suffer from these types of disorders. It also highlights the complexity of our human biology, which I think is always important to do because that always reminds me of how fearfully and wonderfully made we are. And it also highlights another area that I'm very interested in, which is the microbiome, the bacteria that live in our guts. And so these two papers sort of tie all these things together. And it's really built on a model that was probably first described within the past 10 years. But it's something called maternal immune activation. And so this is something that happens in pregnant women or in pregnant mice when they're infected with a virus during pregnancy. And what happens is that can set off an inflammation response, which is part of the immune response. And what they found is that in a mouse model, where they mimic a viral infection by introducing a compound called poly-IC. It basically looks like double-stranded RNA to the mouse's immune system, the same way that a virus presents. It actually sets up a cascade of events that results in a particular type of immune cell being prevalent, something called a T-helper cell. And it's a specific kind of T helper cell that secretes a particular chemical called a cytokine that's classified as interleukin type 17A. That's kind of more information than we probably need. But it's a pretty important helper cell that's being upregulated. And what they find is that this upregulation of this T helper cell increases the amount of interleukin 17 in systematically. And that same enzyme, that same cytokine, is found in women who have infections as well. And so this maternal immune activation happens both in human beings, women who are pregnant, and in mice who are pregnant. And they have a stimulus like a viral infection or something that mimics a virus like the poly-IC. And so what happens in the mouse model is that it actually results in offspring in the mice that have symptoms that mimic neurological disorders, including autistic spectrum disorders. Such things as abnormal communication, increased repetitive behaviors, deficits in sociability, and there's also a neuropathological element that happens in the mice that has also been found in autistic individuals. And it's a type of malformation is not quite the right word. It's architecture that's not normal in parts of the cortical regions of the brain. And these are called cortical patches. And what they find is that these cortical patches are in direct response to the upregulation and differentiation of this particular type of T cell, which secretes this particular cytokine that basically has a correlation of a receptor, so that's another protein that sort of gets the signal from the secreted cytokine, in the fetal brain. And that receptor is responding to the increased levels of interleukin 17, and that part of what happens in result of that is the fetal brain is developing, is it doesn't develop correctly. And so this is observed through these patches, and those patches are also seen in human cases. So the correlations between the model and the human being is there's a good groundwork there for making some inferences. But we always have to remember that no matter how good the model is, it's still just a model, and a mouse is very different than a human being. But what they've also found is that if the mice are not pregnant, they don't have the same type of immune response. So there's something going on in the event of pregnancy itself. And as you can imagine, the hormones in human beings and in mice during pregnancy change quite drastically. And this is having some type of an effect on the immune system. In addition to that, you've got some kind of perturbation that's causing an inflammation response. In humans, it's a viral infection. In mice, it can be a viral infection, or this poly-IC is being introduced artificially to create the maternal immune activation. But then you also need this particular type of T cell to already be present. And that's really important. So you can't wait sort of for the system to differentiate the T cells and produce this type of T cell. This T cell needs to already be present when the perturbation of the immune system happens. And what they found in one of the publications is that T cell is already present because there's a type of bacteria in the gut microbiome that's helping that T cell to differentiate from the T cell pool, right? And so it's basically priming the system to have this T cell there. Well, with that T cell there, what then happens is interleukin 17 gets upregulated, it gets secreted into the system, it upregulates the receptor in the brain, and the two interact, and that's what's resulting in the autistic spectrum disorder-like behavior. And so they can show this through many different ways, that if they block the ability of the T cell to differentiate, if they block the ability of the T cell or the secreted IL-17 to interact with the receptor, if they remove the receptor, if they treat with an antibiotic, a broad-spectrum antibiotic that actually destroys this particular type of bacterial species called segmented filamentous bacteria, if they can actually destroy that type of bacteria or bring it down to a very low level, all of those things can prevent the disorders in the offspring in these pregnant mice that are exposed to either a virus or to the poly-IC. And so that's pretty exciting, because if you can translate that back into the human model, what it means is that maybe if we can prevent immune dysregulation during pregnancy, that perhaps the cascade of events that leads to a change in the cortical brain architecture that is correlating strongly to autistic spectrum disorders, other neurological disorders, and psychological disorders, that maybe these kinds of diseases won't actually be manifest in children or in mouse offspring. Mm. So that's the hope. And one of the other things that's pretty cool, the second paper actually identified specific regions in the cortical areas of the brain that are related. One specific one innervates a particular type of neuron in the brain, and that actually is correlated with the socialization disorders. And it's a different type of neuron that's also being stimulated from that same area, the cortical area that's got the malformed architecture. But that second area is actually related to the repetitive behaviors that are observed. And so they're starting to pick apart sort of the neurological network and connections that might be at play in some of the symptoms that we see in autistic spectrum disorders. So one of the reasons I really like these two papers is because it's building a model that is actually fairly robust and has some really strong correlation in human epidemiological data that we've collected. And by building that model and allowing us to start to pick apart, you know, what cytokines are involved, what bacteria might be involved, we're actually able to test multiple things. And it's suggesting to us, and where I was going earlier, is that in about 90% of the mice, they have these cortical patches, this architecture that's disrupted. But in about 10 to 12% of the mice, they still have ASD, autistic spectrum disorder-like behavior. And so they're basically saying this is one node of a network that's probably contributing to these types of disorders, which makes it even more complex than we've already made it by saying, well, you have to be pregnant and have hormones going on. You have to have some kind of immune perturbation like viral infection. You have to already have commensal bacteria in your gut that's stimulating the production of these particular types of T cells. And then you have to have all of those things in conjunction in order to actually get the symptom. And it has to happen at a particular point in time, right? So in the mouse model, it has to happen at roughly day 12.5 of gestation. Because if you look at day 15.5 and try and set up the maternal immune activation at day 15.5, just 3 days later, won't work, or it doesn't work nearly as well. And if you wait until 18.5 days of gestation, it doesn't work at all. You don't get any of the changes in the brain architecture. And so it's saying there's a discrete amount of time that it seems like the immune system can actually dysregulate and cause abnormalities in brain development or in neurological development. And so if we can find ways to intervene at that point in time, once we've been able to identify the correlate of time for a human mother, then we would be able to do possible treatments. Maybe something like broad-spectrum antibiotic treatment, maybe something like probiotics, where you're introducing commensal bacteria or bacteria that might compete against the ones that are upregulating these particular types of T cells. So I really like this because it's not only developing this model that we can rigorously test and open up scientific inquiry, but it actually silences bad science and conclusions that are drawn mostly just sort of on anecdotal experiences. And what do I mean by that? Well, I've written a couple of articles, you know, about vaccine safety, and a lot of people will still point to a cause of autism as related to vaccines. And
that's
what we've
really
known
out there, yeah.
And what we've known for a long time is that no, signs of autism can actually show up in utero while the baby is still being carried by the mother. And this is being played out in these mouse studies as well. That's absolutely true, that some of these events that are life lasting in the adult offspring actually are triggered in utero. And so this is something that I think, you know, hopefully as we learn more, and especially more about human relevant cytokines, the signaling pathways, the microbiome, neuronal development and neurological networks, maybe one day we'll be able to treat and prevent things like autism or schizophrenia or other neurological or psychological disorders.
What would you say? I mean, there's some of that that, you know, it's exciting that there are things we can do to work at prevent, but it also now kind of puts it on, is there something the mom did that caused this? You get where I'm going with that question? And
yeah,
how would you...
Yeah. Yeah, I man, that's almost as bad as like jumping on the vaccine bandwagon. Because
I agree, but I, you know, that
because
was my
you know
immediate
most of us aren't
so
out there. Most of us out aren't out there going, oh gee, what viral infection can I pick up, right? And you know, it's not like we're trying to expose ourselves to viral infections, or it's not like we have our microbiomes screened regularly, so we know we already have this commensal bacteria or a commensal bacteria that's similar to it that mm-hmm. might be causing the same thing. So those are just. I mean, I think that's just a consequence of living in the world that we live in, right? We all incur risks. But as we unpack what's really happening and what's really contributing, then we can take positive interventions, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a big difference between, okay, we learned that drinking alcohol can lead to fetal syndrome, right, and deformations in mm-hmm. the fetus. And so now a responsible pregnant woman who knows that she's pregnant probably wouldn't consume large amounts of alcohol, right? And so we know that exposure to other things can be really harmful to the unborn child, and the responsible mom avoids those, right? If she's informed, she avoids those.
Well, so, I guess you know, part of that I was just thinking is that my guess is you know, we haven't had so much of that, but I've got kids with allergies and stuff. There's part of it is like, you know, what did I do to cause this? That kind of naturally plays out there. And in some sense, this is saying this is almost, by identifying, these are almost beyond your control, which kind of could alleviate some of that.
Yeah,
they are
somewhat beyond our control, but something, okay, so even like the peanut allergy, there is sort of a correlation between that example and this example in that as societies, you know, we've changed. We've changed in sort of our the way that we consume food, the types of food that we consume, mm-hmm. the types of hygiene that we practice, and whether or not our kids are exposed to certain types of antigens mm-hmm. like peanuts in a particular age range. So some of it is shifts in society mm-hmm. And the way that we consume food or interact or our hygiene. But a lot of those things, again, it's not something that as we're doing them, we know that we're increasing our risk for certain things. Right? So.
Right.
Now, can you put this to the test? I mean, it's interesting. You kind of laid out, you know, what causes all this. We know roughly the percentage of autistic spectrum people in the population.
Yeah.
Does that percentage match what this study would predict?
Yeah, that's impossible to answer, right? Because another thing that I think that these studies are showing, even though they don't state this explicitly, is that just the introduction of a particular type of species of bacteria can shift your entire immune profile to the point of actually possibly contributing to disease in the offspring that is long-lasting, lifelong-lasting, that... My microbiome, my gut microbiome, the bacteria in my gut is not going to be the same as the bacteria in your gut. Number one, because we eat very differently. Yours is probably going to be a much healthier microbiome than mine is, right? But if
we need to all go green like you.
Well, you know, there are certain things that are probably really good for our microbial well-being. But again, we're just sort of picking some of those things apart. And because of that, we have no idea, number one, first of all, how many specific bacteria infect human microbiomes that are related to any type of sort of the system that I laid out was laid out in mice, right? There are some correlates like the increased amounts of interleukin-17, the increase in cortical patches in autistic patients in the brain morphology. But until we sort of identify all of those things for human beings, and not just in the mouse model, but we actually prove the correlation of those things or things like them in the human model, then we can't even begin to address by screening women randomly, do you have the right microbiome? Do you have the right, you know, and it would have to happen during pregnancy because all of these things don't set up the same immune cascade if the woman's not pregnant or if the damn mouse isn't
pregnant.
What makes
this seem credible to me, AJ, is that it's in the right ballpark.
Yeah.
In the sense that, you know, this is really the cause of autistic spectrum disorders, we're going to get like, you know, 0.5 to 1% of the population, and maybe that would stimulate some further research. Can we actually get some predictive, greater predictive tools
I think statistically trying to predict the percentage is still going to be outside of our ability to do just yet, but I think that these papers and ones that were published in 2011 and 2016 are really on the right track of opening up the science and sort of unpacking just how complex it is and areas we can take our studies.
Well, another question. I mean, some cultures of humanity, they quarantine the women at certain points in their pregnancy.
I don't think we need to do that, Hugh.
Okay.
I think if we're gonna take drastic actions, sort of as yet unconfirmed in the scientific literature, but if we were going to try and take radical actions based on what little we know today, that the first thing we would do is in the first trimester and second trimester of pregnancy, prescribe broad-spectrum antibiotics.
But that's got consequences.
It does.
Yeah.
But hopefully not these consequences.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. I have an RTB 101 type question for people who are perhaps new to RTB or to this podcast or average Joes like me. They hear you talk about these mouse studies. And this is one of those questions, Fuzz, that people raise when it comes to genetic similarities. They often wonder, why are they doing these mouse studies? And this would be helpful for people who wonder about the genetic similarities. Maybe you can answer that kind of question.
You know, I think there's really good foundation for an answer to that question from our RTB creation model, right, where it's common design.
Yeah.
Right. And I actually think as I think about these types of studies and the work that I've done as a scientist and that I read about now as a scholar researcher, that God has intended for us to learn some of the things that are true about the design of ourselves by being able to look at the creation around us. And so, you know, we can't do these types of studies. You can't biopsy a brain of a 2-day-old pup, a 2-day-old human, right? You can't do these types of studies in a human being. But you can do them responsibly and ethically in mice, and you can actually get to the point where in a mouse model you might be able to approach statistical estimates because you can do it repeatedly in a number of different mice, right? And you can change parameters so that you're actually pinpointing maybe single pathways or single types of cells or single molecules or cytokines that are making these types of signals. And to be able to do that in a human population would be, number one, you couldn't do it, some of it, right, because you just can't do these types of experiments in human. But in order to collect the similar type of data to make any kind of scientific correlation that is strong inference, right, you can conclusion you might be happy accepting, it would take a huge number of human beings to reach statistical significance in doing these types of experiments where you're only collecting data like a cytokine profile from all pregnant women or taking microbiome samples from all pregnant women and then following them for months until they have deliveries and then following the children for a year or two until maybe they manifest autistic spectrum disorders or other neurological disorders.
How
right?
long is the generation for mice, the pregnancy?
So the pregnancy for a mouse is typically 18 to 20 days.
Oh, okay.
So very not very fast, long. Too. Yeah, very fast. And they get pregnant really quick, too. So so they can drop a litter and be pregnant within another couple of days. So,
Well, you know, in a broader sense, excuse me, this idea of shared features that we see in humans and other animals, again, that's we understand as evidence for common design as opposed to common descent, I think is really a very powerful pointer to something profound about the Creator, and that is that the world around us, the biological world around us, is designed for discovery. And that allows us to see who the Creator is, but also it's part of God's providence, as AJ is alluding to, you know, with the idea that this mouse model can be so valuable for understanding diseases that affect human beings. Because I've engaged atheists who've raised the question, well, why would God, who's an infinite creator, employ these archetypical designs that are found throughout biology? Why not create organisms that had a wide range of different types of biologies? He's an infinite creator, after all. He's all-powerful. And, you know, of course, you know, God could have done it that way. But if God did it that way, there's no way we could know anything whatsoever about the biological realm. We'd have to study every organism and learn everything we can about every organism, but it only applies to that organism. Whereas because things share archetypical designs, because there's a universal nature to biochemistry, by understanding the biochemistry of the bacterium E. coli, for example, which is probably an organism we know the most about on the planet, we have this capacity to apply that knowledge to every life form on the planet. And there's obviously similarities and differences that we have to always account for, but biology would not be possible if it wasn't for these shared features. So to me, I think it reflects God desiring for us to discover him through the record of nature, but also it's part of God's providence, because there's no way we could know, again, anything about biology if it wasn't for these shared features.
You know, that's something I've wondered, how robust an argument you could make that, because the idea of the discoverability of creation, because it's anecdotal in my mind at this point, but I know there's numerous places in the physical sciences, chemistry, physics, astronomy, where our ability to do something, it almost required this special circumstance that allowed us to see it. Even with the confirmation of general relativity, it was the fact that we have solar eclipses, that it's really phenomena that's far beyond what the technology of the time could handle. But there was some handle or some tool, some event that allowed us to get a handle on it so that we could know where to explore deeper. And I think of that even with our grand unified theories and quantum gravity. It's, the energy scales are so far beyond what we could actually produce in the lab, but yet they're somehow accessible in these odd ways. And it almost seems like it's put together so that we can jump the bridge just enough, but then also you can explore it very richly when you're there. So I've often wondered how robust that argument could be made. It's just kind of anecdotal in my mind at this point.
Yeah, but, well, I mean, I think the argument may be more robust in biology than it would be in physics.
Okay.
Because when you look at the history of thought in biology, the first thing that people did was start to categorize organisms.
Mm-hmm.
And once you started putting organisms into categories, whatever you studied as a representative organism for that category was true for the category.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think biology is eminently designed for discoverability. And it traces back to the earliest work that you see among the ancient Greeks, mm-hmm. Who were studying, living systems and trying to make sense of them. And
which
so,
is somewhat remarkable considering how complex living systems are. I mean,
yes. Yeah, but they're complex, but yet you can very quickly recognize similarities that cause organisms to naturally group together.
Yeah.
And the more that we probe biology using more sophisticated techniques, where we're now moving into an arena that is beyond our natural capacity to observe, we still continue to see these shared similarities. I think, AJ gives this wonderful lecture on why would God create viruses, and has this slide that's provocative where you show how important viruses have been for advancing our understanding of molecular biology. And there's, mm-hmm. 15 Nobel Prizes
that are linked to virus
virus research.
Wow.
And it's not understanding what the viruses are doing. It's that insight led to a broader understanding of molecular biology.
And cellular biology.
Right, yeah.
And what's going on there, again, is the fact that these particles, these microscopic particles, are made up of nucleic acids and proteins, and the processes that take place in the cell when these viruses and take over or co-opt the cell's machinery are providing us with insight that from those experiments alone, we suddenly now know what's going on in virtually every living organism. So that to me is remarkable.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense in a theistic framework, that where there's a God who wants us to discover him.
There's also a providential point. I mean, the fact that mice and rats have all these shared design features with us means we can exploit them for medical research.
Yes. Ethically exploit them.
Ethically exploit them. Well, I mean, I visited a mouse lab when I was at the University of British Columbia. They had 12,000 mice, and 10,000 rats in this relatively small facility. And I remember talking to the director where he said, you know, the amazing thing about these rodents is that you can house them relatively inexpensively.
That's right.
They're cheap to feed, and they don't mind being around thousands of their buddies. They seem to enjoy that. And they got this short generation time of just 3 months. It says, you can't imagine a more ideal medical lab animal than a mouse or a rat, and yet we have the creator giving them all these similarities with human beings. It's like he anticipated mm-hmm. our need for medical research by designing these creatures in an optimal way.
Yep. Well, and there's nothing about mouse and rat that says, oh, yeah, this looks like a human ought to behave. I mean, superficially and to the person outside, there's nothing about that that says that's where I ought to look. I mean,
yeah, well, and we do need to be careful, right? Because there's another saying in animal research that says mice lie and monkeys exaggerate. So, you can draw some correlations, but you always have to test it out and make sure that the correlation holds
up. But I agree with you, and I think the point would be, if we didn't even have that capacity to study, we would be at ground zero.
Absolutely. So the insights we gain are invaluable.
Right.
And we would never be able to gain as many as we do if we were left only studying ourselves. Our own species.
Well, I remember one other thing this director said. Says, go pick up one of these mice. Says, you're a total stranger. The mouse has never seen you before. And I could randomly pick up a mouse, no problem. Says, try doing that with a chimpanzee.
You know, I've got to tell you
it with a hamster.
I've got to tell you my lab rat story. When I was in graduate school, I was doing work on bacterial systems. And so I was in the chemistry department, and we collaborated with a microbiologist in the microbiology department. And he was interested in infectious diseases. And so they were using rats to generate white blood cells. It was kind of a little bit of a disturbing procedure to describe how they got the white blood cells from the rats. But the rats ultimately were sacrificed as a part of the process. But every so often I would go into their lab and they would have these long racks of rats in cages on this cart that they could wheel in so they could start harvesting the white blood cells. And one day a couple of rats got loose and they couldn't catch them. And so for about a year and a half, whenever you would go to the lab, there would be these rats scurrying around. Well, I would do a lot of work at night in that lab. And so I would go in about midnight and turn on the lights, and there would always be a rat on the lab bench.
The free republic of rats.
And so these rats went from experimental animals to lab pets.
How you doing, buddy?
Pets.
They'd be at eye level, huh?
It is amazing the affinity they have for human beings. I mean, they really do seem okay to have us handling them.
I have to tell you, though, I haven't done much in rats. I've done a lot in mice, and they're categorically different. Even though they're morphologically, they look very similar to us. Rats are far more intelligent, I think, than mice are. And you can tell as a researcher who's ethically aware, And so I would just like to go on record as saying that there are all kinds of ethical protocols that people who handle animals have to deal with. And and that includes enrichment of their life in the cages. And so they'll have toys and things like that that they can and materials that they can build nests and habituate, pleasantly.
I don't think my cats are following those protocols, AJ.
I don't know.
Cats are held to a different ethical standard.
Do you need me to send in an investigative team, Joe, to your house?
They're leaving an average of about one per week on the
mice.
On the doorstep. Yeah.
The ethics of cats are different than the ethics of human beings.
Oh, boy.
All right. Responsible research.
Well, thank you for that report. Fascinating stuff. Okay, Fuzz, well, let's switch it over to you. Fuzz, as you go around the country and the world, really, and speak, one of the more common questions you receive concerns the endosymbiont hypothesis. And that's what you want to talk about in this paper here. If I read correctly in this Biology Direct abstract, it looks like they're trying to address about 12 different questions here. So let's get the bottom line on what
this paper that I'm going to talk about was a critical review published in a journal called Biology Direct by evolutionary biologists from Hungary. And one of them is a very famous evolutionary biologist by the name of Urs Submarthy, and he, along with a collaborator, essentially are looking at explanations for the origin of eukaryotic cells, focusing on the origin of mitochondria, and in doing so, have essentially identified some significant deficiencies in trying to explain the origin of eukaryotic cells. And this is really important because this work represents, I think, a very important response to the broad claim that basically evolutionary mechanisms can fully account for the origin, the history, and the design of life. And that broad claim, for many people, fuels atheism or agnosticism. That was true for me when I was an undergraduate student learning biology and being exposed to the evolutionary paradigm as an undergraduate student. I didn't know if God existed or not at that time. And as I was learning about, again, evolutionary theory, the implication was that evolution can explain everything that we see in biology. We don't need a creator. And so why believe in God if we don't need God, if God is superfluous? And there are Christian students I interact with who are in college, usually having had a biology 101 course, that are exposed to that broad claim, but as part of this idea of the endosymbiont hypothesis that seems to be so compelling, and as a result of that, they struggle with their faith. Again, for the same reason, if we can explain everything with evolution, why do we need to believe in God? And the way I like to respond to that broad claim is twofold. One is to point out what I believe to be significant failed predictions of the evolutionary paradigm, because if there are failed predictions of the evolutionary paradigm, that's indicating that maybe this paradigm doesn't have all sufficient explanatory power. But the other approach I like to point out is that there are key transitions in the history of life that the evolutionary model can't account for. The origin of life, as we'll see in a minute, the origin of what are called eukaryotic cells, which is very important because plants and animals and fungi are made up of eukaryotic cells. We can't explain the origin of sexual reproduction. We can't explain the origin of body plans. We can't explain the origin of consciousness. And we can't explain the origin of what we might call human exceptionalism. This is really rather significant because these are not only major transitions in the history of life, these are the major transitions in the history of life. And it's interesting to me that none of them have explanation in an evolutionary framework. Now, there's models that have been proposed to account for those transitions, but as we'll see when we look at this particular critical review, those models don't withstand serious scientific scrutiny. It's one thing to have a model to explain something. It's another thing to show that model is robust and truly has explanatory power. And so a little bit of background before we plow into this. There are two different cell types that we see in biology, at least the first approximation. One would be prokaryotic cells. Bacteria and archaea are made up of prokaryotic cells. These groups are single-celled organisms, and the prokaryotic cell is about a micron in size, I guess. That's a typical size. It has a cell membrane, a cell wall, but no observable internal structures. There's internal organization at a molecular level, but there's no internal structures in prokaryotic cells. When we move to the next cell type, eukaryotic cells, these are much larger, 20 to 30 microns in size, but they're characterized by having a nucleus, a membrane-bound spherical structure in the interior of the cell, the nucleus that harbors the genetic material. There's a network of membranes that performs a variety of functions in the cell. There are all these membrane-bound organelles. And eukaryotic cells are what we would typically learn about in a biology class, in an introductory biology class. Now, the evolutionary model for how eukaryotic cells emerge from prokaryotic cells is called the endosymbiont hypothesis. This is the leading idea. There's actually other models that have been proposed, but most of those models are considered now to be kind of afterthoughts. But this idea originated in the early 1900s in Russia by proposed by a Russian botanist, but it was Lynn Margulis in the 1960s who really elaborated this idea and presumably substantiated it by work in studying microorganisms. And the idea here is that the eukaryotic cells emerge through a process in which a mother cell, probably an archaean, engulfs other bacteria and forms this internal symbiotic relationship with those bacteria. They are called endosymbionts. And over time, those endosymbionts become integrated into the host cell's metabolism, and those endosymbionts undergo a process of genome reduction and become kind of enslaved to the host cell through that process and devolve to the point where they are now organellular type structures in the cell. So that's in a broad sense this endosymbiont hypothesis. And it turns out that mitochondria are kind of like the poster child for endosymbiosis. And we'll find out in a minute that the origin of mitochondria is deeply intertwined with the origin of eukaryotic cells. And this is highly mysterious why that particular organelle is, but it seems like you really don't have the origin of eukaryotic cells until you have the origin of mitochondria. But the argument for endosymbiosis or an endosymbiotic origin of mitochondria would be the size of mitochondria are about the same size as the bacterial group that people believe produced mitochondria. These would be alpha proteobacteria. Both the bacteria and the mitochondria have double membrane systems. They both have circular DNA in their interior. The DNA metabolism in the alpha proteobacteria is similar to the DNA metabolism in mitochondria. There's cardiolipin, which is a highly unusual lipid in the inner membranes of these alpha proteobacteria, found in the inner membrane of mitochondria. And there are these porin proteins found in the outer membrane of alpha proteobacteria that are found in the outer mitochondrial membrane, or at least they're porin analogs. And so when you put that all together, it looks as if mitochondria are derived from these alpha proteobacteria through this process of endosymbiosis. Now, this is why college students who have had a biology class ask me this question, because that seems like a really compelling case for endosymbiosis as a mechanism to account for eukaryotic organisms. And this is where this particular paper comes into play, because these researchers point out that when you look at the origin of eukaryotes focusing on mitochondria, there are over 20 different specific hypotheses that have been proposed, or models that have been proposed, that umbrella under endosymbiosis. And they point out that probably half of those aren't even credible. They say there are 12 models that are reasonable models, but they argue that if those models are going to be successful, they have to answer a series of 12 questions. And they point out that none of the models actually answer all 12 of those questions. And I'm just going to take a quick second and...
What's the closest one of them comes? How many of those 12 questions?
Oh, you would ask that question.
Yeah, sorry.
they have a nice table here in the paper.
Well, I'll look while you go on.
Yeah, there's a nice table in the paper where they catalog... Here it is.
Okay.
Some of the problems, for example, that... And I'm not going to go through all 12 questions, but just to give people some concrete examples of where we see problems with this model. For example, why is the origin of mitochondria so deeply intertwined with the origin of eukaryotic cells? And again, nobody knows the answer to that. Some people think that maybe the mitochondria were the last the last organelle to be established in the last eukaryotic common ancestor. That's why it's so intertwined. Others think that it may have been the first organelle to be produced, and because it generates energy for the cell, actually provided the energy needed for the other stages of endosymbiosis to take place. Again, nobody knows the answer to that question. Another thing that's really problematic is, why are there not any intermediate organisms? We have prokaryotic cells and we have eukaryotic cells. We have nothing in between that would document kind of the intermediary stages in the process of endosymbiogenesis. Nothing in between. Now, we do have eukaryotic cells that lack mitochondria, but those are believed to have lost the mitochondria as a secondary event. So there's nothing, no intermediate grade. In fact, it looks as if the last eukaryotic common ancestor was actually as complex as a typical eukaryotic cell was, meaning it seems like this endosymbiogenesis process happened virtually instantaneously, where everything seems to be happening simultaneously. And in fact, this is dubbed the eukaryotic Big Bang, where we have the sudden appearance of eukaryotic cells without any kind of intermediate grades.
This is another Big Bang. Huh?
Well, this is a real problem because the process of endosymbiogenesis has got to be a long, elaborate process. To build an entire eukaryotic cell. So this is a very serious problem. Another problem is eukaryotic cells, according to this viewpoint, seem to be chimeric, meaning the information processing systems where DNA is being metabolized looks like that of an archaean, but the membranes in the eukaryotic cell look like bacterial membranes. Archaea have a very different membrane system than do bacteria. And if the mother cell was initially thought to be an archaean, then why don't the membranes look archaeal-like? Why do they look like bacterial membranes? This is, again, highly mysterious, particularly since nobody knows how an organism could swap one set of membranes for another set of membranes. There's no mechanism to explain that. Membrane bioenergetics is also a problem. And what I mean by that is the processes that generate the energy for the cell to use are confined to the plasma membrane in bacteria and archaea. Okay, well, in eukaryotic cells, all that energy metabolism is happening in the membrane systems of mitochondria. The plasma membranes and the internal membranes of eukaryotic cells show no evidence of ever having been used for membrane bioenergetics. That again is deeply problematic, and perhaps the biggest problem that these researchers identify is what on earth would establish that endosymbiotic relationship, because if the mother cell takes in a bacteria and it's engulfed and it somehow escapes digestion, the most obvious thing for it to happen is it would be digested away. It wouldn't survive that engulfment process. Phagocytosis is the technical term. If it did somehow survive that, and the internal environment of that mother cell was conducive for that engulfed bacteria to survive, it should just basically replicate out of control and completely destroy the mother cell. And so there's no way to account for how that endosymbiotic relationship would be established that then in turn could lead to the genome reduction and the conversion of that organism into an organelle. So these are just some of the problems that these researchers identify as being outstanding questions that no model can actually account for. And so they're calling for, in this paper, they're calling for a new model. There needs to be a new model to explain this. And so here's three quotes that I pulled from the paper that I think are incredibly provocative, and then I'll go ahead and kind of bring things to a close. They say this: the integration of mitochondria was a major transition and a hard one. It poses puzzles so complicated that new theories are still generated 100 years since endosymbiosis was first proposed and 50 years since Lynn Margulis cemented the endosymbiotic origin of mitochondria into evolutionary biology. Elsewhere, they say, one would expect that by this time, there is a consensus about the transition, but far from it. Even the most fundamental points are still debated. And then finally, they say, there's no single theory that can adequately answer all questions. Furthermore, and more importantly, some answers have turned out to be untenable in light of new results. The point I'm making here is this. this does not sound to me like a theory that's well established. This does not sound to me like there's an explanation for the origin of eukaryotic cells, which again is a major transition in the history of life on Earth. Because if this event doesn't happen, animals don't happen, plants don't happen, fungi don't happen. Okay, all the multicellular organisms are eukaryotic organisms. So this is a critical transition in the history of life, and the evolutionary paradigm cannot account for it. Though the perception is that evolutionary biologists have this all figured out, and that's what's communicated to students in introductory biology classes, and along with that, the larger point that evolution can explain everything. And so, to me, this is significant because it shows that the evolutionary paradigm lacks explanatory power, and therefore, it's legitimate to be skeptical that this is the explanation for the origin, the history, and the design of life. That if you view a creator as playing a role, I think you're on secure grounds, because you can't show that the watchmaker is blind, at least when it comes to this question. And, you know, to me, there's parallels with this and the origin of life. Mm-hmm. That the average person on the street, mm-hmm. the average person on the scientific street, thinks, hey, we've got the origin of life problem figured out. It's the RNA world hypothesis, yeah. right? Yeah. But when you get into the community of researchers and engage them, they're quick to admit we have no clue. If you start digging into the scientific literature, it becomes evident we don't have a clue. Well, the same thing's going on here when it comes to endosymbiosis. Nobody has a clue as to what's happened here. There's a model. It's a popularized model that everybody accepts as being true, just like everybody accepts chemical evolution as being true. But the fact of the matter is you can't robustly show that this model has credibility. So I think this is, again, really important given how prominent this idea is in evolutionary biology and how often I have students who are on a university campus who've taken biology courses asking me about the endosymbiont hypothesis. So this is, to me, again, really important. And if people want to dig a little bit deeper, we've written a number of articles now on our website that deal with the endosymbiosis, the idea of endosymbiogenesis, or the endosymbiont hypothesis, where I identify some specific problems with it. So if people want to dig deeper, they can. But I think this is really interesting because this review was literally just published a few weeks ago. So the state of the art is we don't have a clue of how eukaryotic cells emerge.
And I think it's interesting because it's, you know, it's sort of the first step, like you already said. It's the first step in sort of the macroevolutionary paradigm for accounting for all of life's history and diversity, right? And this is the first step, getting from a prokaryote, relatively simple single-cell organism, which isn't really all that simple,
exactly,
to a much more complex eukaryote, and we still don't have a clue.
Yep.
Yeah, I think there's a positive argument here. I just want to see what do you think about this, Fuzz, because I heard you explaining the membrane similarities in the mitochondria and these bacterial cells. Could that be used as an argument for common design?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So there's common design going on even in the cellular components.
Yes. Well, for example, I've written some articles, again, not only critiquing the endosymbiont hypothesis, but also explaining why you have to have cardiolipin in the inner membrane of mitochondria and the inner membrane of bacteria, that it actually is performing a critical function related to energy metabolism and the enzymes in those membranes that are performing key processes in producing energy for the cell. I explain why you have to have DNA in the interior of mitochondria because they're coding for proteins that that are too hydrophobic to be produced in the cytoplasm and wind up in the inner membranes of mitochondria, because the cell's machinery can't discriminate between those and proteins that would wind up in the endoplasmic reticulum, for example. And I know for most of our listeners, I just spoke complete gibberish. But the point is there's a rationale for why you have to have certain proteins produced inside mitochondria.
In other words,
it's a delivery problem. You couldn't get the proteins produced elsewhere and delivered properly to the mitochondria.
But from a biblical creation perspective, it explains why we see these common features.
Yes.
in the mitochondria and the bacteria.
Exactly.
And so we're also making a positive argument for a creation model at the same time critiquing the materialistic evolutionary model.
Yes.
Well, I think it's very powerful.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah.
Good point.
So.
All right. Anything else?
Nope.
Great stuff. All right. Three for three. You guys are hitting it out of the park. And now we're going to hit it out into the stratosphere, or beyond that, actually.
Out of the universe.
Out of the,
out of the universe.
Well, not quite that.
Not out of the universe, yeah, but in the outer part of the universe.
Other part of the universe.
All the way back to the beginning of the universe,
yeah,
we're going to hit it that far.
I think we might go that far. Hugh, we're entering a new era.
No pressure, Hugh.
Yeah, right.
New era of experiments, if I read that correctly in the intro, as we are now embarking on powerful tests of cosmology. It says in the abstract here in this paper you want to report on, so let's hear about it.
Yeah, it's a recent paper published in the Astrophysical Journal on a new constraint on what are called primordial magnetic fields.
PMFs. And
that's kind of one of the holy grails of cosmology, is to actually measure these magnetic fields that exist between galaxies and clusters of galaxies. And, you know, there's many cosmic creation models. But these cosmic creation models have significant differences with respect to one another on what they predict to be the extent and the strength of these magnetic fields that are very large scale that exist between galaxies and clusters of galaxies. And they call them primordial magnetic fields because a lot of the thinking is what happens within the first few seconds after the cosmic creation event actually impacts the structure and the strength of these magnetic fields between clusters of galaxies and the galaxies themselves, the intergalactic medium. And so this paper first reviews, and in fact, as I read the paper, it cited about a 40-page review that had been written recently on these primordial magnetic fields. I'll actually be writing a blog article on this so that people can actually go to these papers. And the review paper is fairly easy for lay people to read because they actually let them have a large word count. I mean, you can get the paper for free in the archive, what they call the preprint version. And so I looked at it and was quite impressed. This is quite lay accessible, but basically makes the point of how important our understanding of these primordial magnetic fields is to make significant advances in cosmology and our understanding of the cosmic creation event.
So that's the bottom line.
That's the bottom line. I'll give you a short list. I won't give you the complete list. But for example, if these magnetic fields between clusters of galaxies were to come in at, say, 1/10 quadrillionth of a Gauss, and to give you an idea, the magnetic field of the Earth is about 1 Gauss. The Sun is about 1 Gauss. Jupiter, which is the strongest magnetic field we see in the solar system, has about 10 Gauss. This is, we're talking 1/10 of a quadrillionth of a Gauss, or 10 to the minus 16 Gauss. A very weak magnetic field. A magnetic field that weak, pardon me, well, I misspoke. It's 1/10 of a nanogauss. So it's 1/10 billionth of a Gauss. A field that's a primordial magnetic field that strong, you could get non-Gaussinity in the cosmic background radiation maps. And when the Planck map came out, it was detailed enough to actually show a strong hint of that non-Gaussinity. And people mystify what could possibly explain that. Well, a primordial magnetic field of that strength could actually explain that. In fact, could explain something stronger, that it would explain how you could get dwarf galaxies showing up much earlier in the history of the universe than we think, with greater numbers of dwarf galaxies. It could explain how you would get an earlier reionization event, which means that, you know, the universe as it originated, everything's ionized, but you get a second ionization event when you form the first stars. In fact, different primordial magnetic fields will predict different populations and diversities of the firstborn stars, what we call population 3 stars. And that's been a big mystery within modern astronomy, is that we have yet to see an actual firstborn star. The new telescopes that are coming online will be powerful enough to detect these firstborn stars. And now we're developing models based on these primordial magnetic fields as to what these firstborn stars would look like in terms of their abundance and diversity and sizes. And if we actually can measure that, it's going to give us a lot more insights on what the cosmic creation model looks like, because it would explain, for example, how you get a lot of molecular hydrogen or different quantities of molecular hydrogen. And it would also explain why in large spiral galaxies, like our Milky Way galaxy, we actually measure a large-scale magnetic field that comes in at a microgauss, 1/1,000,000th of a gauss. So that's been a mystery. How do we explain the fact that on the scale of, say, 30,000, 40,000 light years, we see a magnetic field in our galaxy that comes in at 1 microgauss? If there's no primordial magnetic fields, we shouldn't be seeing that. Or if there's a very weak primordial magnetic field, we won't be seeing that. Now, the paper does cite two previous attempts to measure these the strengths of these primordial magnetic fields. Based on your discipline, Jeff, of gamma ray astronomy, two gamma ray astronomy measurements of quasars and blazars have indicated that the primordial magnetic field must have a minimum strength of 1/10 quadrillionth of a gauss. That's where I got that number before. But 1/10 billionth would have these very significant cosmic creation model consequences. And but what the paper focuses on is that these measurements based on gamma rays basically gave us a lower limit, meaning that these primordial magnetic fields must be at least as strong as 1/10 quadrillionth. But that's way too weak to explain what we think is happening in the cosmic background radiation maps and what was happening in the magnetic fields of large galaxies. And what we could be discovering about these firstborn stars, or when we see the first dwarf galaxies form. These are measurements that we're going to easily be able to do with the James Webb Telescope. And so these theoreticians are jumping ahead and saying, if James Webb discovers this, we've got an explanation for it. So it's a great example of how you've got astrophysical theory meshing with astrophysical observations and anticipating what's going to come down the pike. But the base of the real significance of this paper is they took the four best mapping observations now being done of the cosmic background radiation and combined them to develop an upper limit on these primordial magnetic fields.
Yeah, it looks like Planck, Bicep 2, Keck Array, and Polar Bear.
Yeah, those are the four most detailed telescopes, most telescopes that have the most capacity to give detailed mapping the cosmic background radiation. And the big news in this is that they've been able to establish an upper limit that's 3 to 4 times lower than what we had before, basically saying these primordial magnetic fields must be weaker than 0.91 microgauss. Now, everybody kind of knew that it wasn't going to be as strong as a microgauss, but what they're saying is there's actually experiments, new mapping techniques for measuring the cosmic background radiation, which, by the way, is another term for the radiation left over from the cosmic creation event, something called the South Pole Telescope 3G. I don't know where they come up with all these letter designations, but that's within 3 years is going to give us new data, combine what's called the Simons Array. The combination of the Simons Array and the South Pole Telescope 3G observational efforts, by January of 2020, will be able to give us measurements that will be 20 times better than we have today. So instead of being able to establish a limit of 1 microgauss, it's going to be a limit of 0.05. Microgauss. And then the paper ends by saying there is a new instrument that has a very high likelihood of being funded and up and running so that within a decade, that's just 10 years from now, it's called the CMB-S4 experiment. The CMB-S4 experiment will be able to give us a sensitivity 100 times better than what these people are able to publish in this paper. And they say 100 times better means that we have a very high likelihood we're going to be able to get a reasonably accurate measurement of these primordial magnetic fields, which is going to give us the most detailed cosmic creation model by far to date. So exciting news for those of us who are believers in a cosmic creation event.
Hugh, where does this put us in terms of the hot Big Bang creation model? And I'll put it in this context. Let's say there's a sharp person out there, smarter than this average Joe, who wants to engage somebody who might have the ear of a Danny Faulkner or a Jason Lyle and wants to engage them in these kinds of discussions. How would you advise somebody like that?
Well, we're talking about whether or not there is a hot Big Bang creation event. That's overwhelmingly established. I mean, what these papers addressing is exactly what kind of hot Big Bang creation event are we talking about. And this is kind of the way science operates. I mean, we have general agreement that the Big Bang creation model is correct. We have general agreement that the universe is dominated by dark energy and dark matter. But there are details, like I was bringing out here, that are still unknowns. And so I think one of the strengths for the biblically predicted Big Bang model is that as we learn more and more about the universe, we're getting a more detailed picture of the cosmic creation event and the history of the universe from that cosmic creation event. And so it basically demonstrates the more we learn, the more detailed model we're getting, and that therefore the more confidence we can have that what the Bible predicted thousands of years ago actually is correct.
You know, for somebody who is engaging, let's say they are friends with Danny Faulkner or Jason Lyle, and they know quite a bit about astrophysics, would Faulkner or Lyle be impressed with this kind of result?
Well, I think what a young Earth creationist astronomer would do is they would say, you know, we're going to find this story about the firstborn stars is impossible. I mean, they've actually written articles.
Impossible.
They just say, you know, what astrophysicists is, that's make the point. No astrophysicist has ever seen a firstborn star. And, you know, we think that they're not going to find these stars, or they're going to be very different than what they predicted. And so they're basically anticipating that astrophysical research is going to go down a radically different path as we learn more and more. Rather than giving us a more detailed understanding of what we think is already true about the Big Bang creation event, it's going to overturn the Big Bang creation story. We're going to find we're totally wrong about the universe. We're wrong about dark energy. We're wrong about dark matter. We're wrong about these firstborn stars. We're wrong about these magnetic fields. I mean, I've read some of their literature where they claim that this magnetic field understanding of our Milky Way galaxy is a bunch of baloney. And, you know, these future measurements are going to show that astronomers were wrong about almost everything they thought was true about the universe.
Okay, so I guess I'm sorry I asked the question.
Could be.
Jeff, any feedback on that? Or you don't want to weigh in? That'll take too long. Okay. All right, well, good stuff.
But, hey, we're on the way to the holy grail of what these primordial magnetic fields are all about.
When is the James Webb telescope?
Supposed to go up next year.
Oh, wow, that's sooner than I thought.
Well, it's been delayed a long time. And basically what's happened is people at NASA are saying it's been delayed more than a dozen times. It's now time to really make it happen. You know,
government efficiency, huh?
Well, it's like the government's going to be pretty embarrassed if they can't get that thing up there pretty soon.
Okay, great.
The taxpayers are getting impatient.
All right. Okay. Well, thanks to each of you. I think I've learned quite a bit. I don't know if any of you have learned anything from one another. I'm sure you have. The questions have been fantastic.
I'm looking forward to all the articles these people are going to be writing about the discoveries.
I'm looking forward to editing them too.
Well, good.
Some fine blog articles to be written as well. All right. Well, thanks for all your input. Sure appreciate it. To interact with the Scholar team directly and to stay up to date with the apologetic significance of the science news headlines, you know how to find them on their Facebook and Twitter pages. For the team here, Hugh, Fuzz, Jeff, and AJ, this is Joe Aguirre. Thank you for your support. We will see you next time on Scientifica.
We'd like to thank our monthly partners for making this broadcast possible. If you're not a monthly partner or would like information about becoming one, please go to reasons.org/monthlypartners. Also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where you can join the conversation about the latest scientific discoveries, headlines, and their apologetic value.